Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. And this program has been about the evolution of consciousness, our past, our future, and very much about what I feel is coming as far as connection, contact. And that's why I'm very happy to be a part of Contact in the Desert, which is a tremendous festival of consciousness and stories and research about ETs, UFOs, people who have had contact, and researchers and scientists and a bunch of people. And one of the people that are going to be there is tonight's guest, Robin Maxwell, who is actually a writer of historical fiction. Her book, Atlantos, is very interesting. It's been called a science fiction masterpiece, and we'll be talking about the past and the future, the ancient Atlanteans and the possible aliens that are here. So, Robin, welcome to the program.
I'm just so happy to be with you tonight.
Right, and I'm happy you're going to be at Contact in the Desert. Were you there last year at Contact?
No, I missed last year. I was there a couple of years ago, not as a presenter, but as an attendee, and had a wonderful time.
Well, there seems to be a great crossover in the study and the possibility of alien life with ancient civilizations, and I think that's where you really come in, and there'll be other people there beside you, like Graham Hancock, Robert Bavall. These are people who are great experts in the past, but you're writing about it from a whole different point of view as a novel. You're giving human emotions to people of our past. Why did you take that approach to history?
Well, nobody else was doing it. I mean, I had been doing that very thing with my historical fiction in the 15th and the 16th century for many, many years. But I'd had this enduring fascination with extraterrestrials, UFOs, and ancient civilizations. And I guess I got hooked when I read Plato's dialogues, Timaeus and Critias, where he talks about Atlantos in great detail. He talks about the civilization in great detail, but unfortunately, he doesn't say very much about the god Poseidon and his children. And but he does give enough for somebody like me who's used to working with just a few facts, and certainly the farther back you go in history, the fewer facts there are, but what he said about Atlantos, or Atlantis, as he calls it, is that Poseidon, one of the gods, was given as his apportionment the island or the continent of Atlantis, and he met and fell in love with a woman, a native woman named Clito. He calls her Clito. In my novel, I call her Cleota. And what I realized is that the entire civilization of Atlantis became what it was, beginning with this love story, this relationship. He fell in love with this woman, and together they mated, and they had, and this is the interesting thing to me, five sets of twin sons. And I think that's probably statistically close to impossible without some kind of intervention. And so I've always been a believer that in the distant past we have been visited by extraterrestrials. Lately, I've been thinking, I don't know whether they come from the distant stars or different distant planets. They may come from different dimensions, but they were definitely from someplace other than here. Plato tells us these very few facts about this relationship, but if I think that if you're going to tell a story, that anybody's really going to be interested in or learn anything about. You need to make it really human. You need to show the relationships between these people, and that's what I've done. I've just gone out of my way to get into the nitty gritty of not only a love relationship, but a second relationship and jealousies of two brothers who are at war with each other. The great mystery of Plato's account of Atlantis, to my mind, because I always use a mystery in my historical fiction novels. The mystery was why Atlantis went to war with Athens. It just kind of comes out of the blue. Mm-hmm. And I thought this is of major import, because it's
is that in Plato's account that Atlantis?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
But you do think, and I do believe in Plato's account. I do think that the last sinkings of Atlantis were probably about 12,000 years ago. Graham Hancock also confirms that. But I do think that Atlantis probably lasted probably 50,000 years. What Plato's hearing is the last days of Atlantis.
Last gasps of it. Yeah, in that way, to make sure that I had a coherent story, something that people could really relate to, I really bring the time frame down to a couple of hundred years, because, how do you tell a story over 50,000 years? I have to, as a novelist, I have to think that way.
Right.
Yeah.
I just want to ask you one more question about Atlantis, because what I think, and I've read lots of books, I read Plato, I think it probably was in the Atlantic Ocean. I think the Romans changed the S to a C, and it really should be the Atlantis Ocean. But then other people, that's my theory, but other people have said it may be Greenland that floated north, or Antarctica. I don't know how it could be Antarctica. Or that it's under the bottom of the ocean, and some of the mountaintops, like the Isles of Britain.
Canary Islands.
And what did you say? Which part?
The Canary Islands.
Canary Islands, yes. And also possibly the Yucatan, or at least the migration went from Atlantis to Mexico and to Egypt. I know you don't get into that in your book, but what do you think about that?
I am lately, and in this book, because I've been studying this for, 20 some years, and I've changed my view of where Atlantis was. I originally thought it was in the Atlantic Ocean for a while. I was very influenced by Graham Hancock. Right. And, 20 years ago, he wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, and that's where he floated this idea of it being under the ice of Antarctica, but it had been previous to that in a much more temperate zone. And then when shifting of the planet happened and the shifting of the lithosphere, he called it, the whole continent shifted downward toward the pole. So I thought of that for a while. And
I don't know, that's then, a little hard to do in 12,000 years.
He said it happened really, really fast, like, one of these instant things, like a world cataclysm. But I think most recently I've agreed with Graham Hancock again, because he does such amazing research and such thorough
research. And for people to know, Graham Hancock will be at Contact in the Desert also. Actually, I'd love for you two to have a dialogue together somewhere in front of people.
Oh, I'd love that, because he's very much into Atlantis and the first, the first civilization on Earth. But where he's saying it is now is in Southeast Asia, kind of the islands of Java.
That seems ridiculous. Asia. I think he's really off with that. I think there was a great civilization there, probably Lemurian, that has to do with the Yanaguni ruins in the Pacific.
Right.
And but I don't think Atlantis, because they say it was right outside the Pillars of Hercules. I mean, the Greeks didn't want, I think that says it somewhere.
Yes, it does, absolutely. And
Athens was not doing war with something on the other side of the planet that they don't even know exists. I think that's a little silly. I like Graham Hancock, but I don't agree.
Don't agree with that.
I do not at all agree with that. There was a civilization there in ancient Java. There is a book called, what, the Atlantean Java or something like that. There is a book about that.
Yeah. I think a guy named Santos.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just get back to why I thought it was important, this line about, it's more than a line, it's a whole kind of story point, that Atlantis goes to war with Athens. And shortly after that, all hell breaks loose. And that's when, you know, in a single day and night, Atlantis is swallowed up by the sea. And I kept saying, there's nothing in this entire, in either dialogue, to explain why Poseidon went, or why Atlantis went to war with Athens. And so in my novelist's brain, I thought, well, why does one country go to, you know, war with the other? And I said, well, what if Athens isn't just the name of a city? What if it's his brother, and he has a rivalry with his brother? And that's how I started formulling this rather complicated family dynamic, and a brother named Athens who, when Poseidon comes to the earth, to then called Gaia, to do some scientific and genetic experiments.
Well, you have to explain Poseidon is an Anunnaki, isn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's the guy from
Anunnaki are, but anyway, yeah.
The Anunnaki are what the Sumerians called the gods. And they were, in many people's minds these days, they are simply, they're not supernatural. They are simply humans from either another planet or another dimension, and who come to Earth to, well, some people think they enslave other people. Well, in the case of Poseidon, he didn't enslave anybody. He, in the beginning, it was a utopian society, and he built a fabulous civilization. And it was only later that he went to war with his brother, close to the end, well, at the end of the time of Atlantis. And so I just needed a way that, I always try to do that with my books. I try to make it as believable as possible. When you don't have the facts, even if it's the 16th century, you're going to end up with these gigantic gaping holes in history. And that's only 500 years ago. But when it's 12,000 years ago, and I totally agree with you on that timeline, that most of it is a big hole, and you have to take whatever facts that you have. And funnily enough, the only facts that we have about Atlantis come from Plato. No other ancient writer.
Well, I wouldn't even say it's a fact. That, I mean, I would say it's a historical reference, but
right. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, the facts will come when
I have to kind of take up facts.
Well, they have found a lot of stuff off of Bimini. They call that the Atlantean Road. There's a pyramid there that people have seen in the water. So there are some artifacts for sure.
It's more than artifacts in that when you look at the stories, some people call them myths, but the cosmology of people all around the world. You always come back to this flood story, and it's one of the most compelling. That is a fact.
I think the flood. I think the flood has been established as a fact that they've taken from different geological studies, yes.
Right, but also with that comes along the stories of what you can call them the Anunnaki or Viracocha in South America, or, you know, wherever, that the survivors of this flood brought culture to people all over the world. They brought so there's a flood story, and there are stories about these so-called gods who were really just men. They were teachers. I think that the word Viracocha actually means teacher. I could be wrong about that. But anyway, they taught them agriculture. They taught these people, these survivors, really, of the Great Flood. They gave them culture. They gave them agriculture. And it's the remembering of these early days after the flood that, you know, tell us that there was an advanced civilization. Because who are these people if they're not from an advanced civilization?
Right.
So,
even the Chinese have that story of the ancient emperors giving agriculture to humans and
they do.
The three wise men came to China and developed writing and agriculture, and I think even metallurgy working.
Really?
Yes. Look into the Chinese myths of the ancient
ones. That's really very interesting. And do you know anything about, we know about the Yanaguni ruins, but that's off Japan.
Yes.
But are there any flood myths in Japan?
I don't know if there's flood myths in Japan, because I don't know. I think Japan probably was hooked by a land bridge to the mainland of Asia before the flood. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think the flooding of the Pacific was older because of the Lemurian civilization. Yeah. And then, actually, I heard a story that in the time of Atlantis, the clouds covered the earth evenly, and there was an even temperature.
Really?
Yes, and the flood, part of the flood was whatever laser started to condense those clouds, started to fill the oceans higher because of the clouds created the massive precipitation.
Have you heard that? I haven't heard that.
I heard that from Ramtha the Enlightened Ones.
Uh-huh. Right.
What are you asking? Have I heard which one?
Have you heard it's a more recent idea that it was a comet that struck the North American ice.
Well, Graham Hancock's latest discussion, The Magician of the Gods. He goes.
Yes.
Into that, and he probably will at Contact, how I think he says the meteorite caused the ice age, and then another heavy meteor dispelled it.
I did read this most recent book, Magicians of the Gods, and what he's saying is that 12,000, two important dates, 12,800 years ago, a comet, not this is it's actually important that it's a comet. I'm remembering exactly what, but it was a huge comet, hit a 2,000 foot deep ice shelf that was covering most of North America and Canada and into Siberia. And it hit with such force and such heat that it caused the really big flood. And it also caused wildfires from coast to coast in America, and this is what caused the first kind of inundation, and some of the land bridges, were inundated, and so then what happened because of this idea of a nuclear winter or a winter caused by smoke and stuff in the air, that caused us to go back into an ice age. for about 1,000 years and 1,200 years. And then the other important date, and I'm sure you know this date, 11,600, is when Plato says Atlantis sank. And 11,600 years ago, something else happened. And Graham and some other people are saying that that was another comet strike, and it caused the flooding and the of the world again, ended the ice age for good. Until we're still in that. That was a period called the Younger Dryas, and it started with a comet. And he believes it ended with a comet, but there's no proof.
And he also believes that we're due for a comet. You know that. He
yes,
also says that.
Right, yes. That's the end of the book. But, we have scientific facts. I mean, we're pretty sure now that comet happened. But what we're lacking are these human stories. And what I find I'm doing, because, I'm in the middle of writing the sequel to Atlantis called Children of Ra. Uh-huh. And what I'm doing, I'm finding myself, I'm world building. And that's so much fun.
What do you mean by that term, world building?
World building. Well, I start with the idea that that there was a place called Atlantis. I have to start from something solid, and I believe that. So, but there's no detail, even in Plato, about how it came together. I mean, he does say that, he says Poseidon and Cleita, mated. They had 10 sons, and those 10 sons mated with the native children, which is very reminiscent of the sons of God and the daughters of man. And then he actually says, Plato actually says, that they gathered the tribes of the continent and brought them together. But he does not, Plato does not say how this famous city of rings, this quite advanced civilization, how these natives, even under the guidance of Poseidon, how this fabulous city was built. And that's what I do. That when I talk about world building, in my book, I describe how Atlantis was actually built. Mm. And it was built using some technology. But I've given, all great heroes in literature have kind of the fatal flaw or the conundrum that
they're yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And Poseidon's is that he has come from a technologically advanced planet, and I call it Teres, but in fact it's Planet X, the planet that they've just, scientists have just confirmed something that we've known for a long time, this planet in this long elliptical orbit. So I have him and his brother coming from there. Brother goes to Mars, to mine, and Poseidon comes to Earth, and he is he falls in love. The first thing that happens is he falls in love with this planet because it is such a magnificent planet. And I have fallen in love with Earth. I now live out in the middle of nowhere in a most gorgeous place. And I wrote this book just after I moved out here. I live actually near Joshua Tree, where the Contact in the Desert is held. And so I gave that to Poseidon for a character, kind of an important bit of his character, that he falls in love with Earth, and then he falls in love with a woman, an Earth woman, and he doesn't want to use his technology. He just has this gut feeling that, if he's going to build a society, because he has this idea of building, of building a city, and there haven't been any cities on Earth yet. And he wants to do that, but he doesn't want to push the local population into anything too fast, because he knows that it'll screw them up. So he believes in the people of Earth. He thinks they're evolved enough and they're beautiful people and they're passionate. And these are all the things that he doesn't have. He's from a kind of a cool culture, a high technos and kind of low emotion kind of culture. And he just, so this is his conundrum for both books, is how do I rule, or not rule, but govern? How do I govern? Because he's a real benevolent ruler. And the sons, of course, the sons want progress. They want the technology, and he's constantly fighting with them about, because he has a feeling it's going to screw things up. And guess what? In the end, it does. That's in book two.
Well, are you making a statement about modern times?
Yes, you bet I am.
But don't you think technology can also be beneficial?
Of course it can. Of course, we wouldn't be talking today. There's so much. But that's what I say. It's a conundrum. He knows that he wouldn't be where he is if it hadn't been for technology. He wouldn't have found the love of his life. He wouldn't have found this beautiful planet. But in many ways, it's screwing things up. I mean, don't you think so, Alan?
I think it's also possibly has the potential to make things better, to make our planet closer. I don't know if it's technology that is screwing things up or people.
It's a combination of people with technology running wild.
The problem. I think, yes, I think some technology, the buildup of atomic weapons, I think that's,
the things that are causing climate change.
What about climate change?
The forces that are causing climate change.
Yes, I think
that's technology.
I think it is technology, but I think technology technology was fire. Fire was the new technology. It had the ability to burn things or cook things and warm you. And so I think technology has always been a double-edged sword. And humans have to understand the right relationship to it.
Well, that's easy to say, but they're not. Because human beings are human beings, and they have a fatal flaw, which is, you tell me. It's greed.
More than one.
Greed and ignorance. Yeah, greed, ignorance, a tendency toward violence. And, like you say, people have to understand this. Well, they should, but they don't. And so, my books are the two of them, Atlantis and Children of Ra, they are going to be a cautionary tale. About what we can do to our civilization by misusing it. It's not that it's evil, it's the misuse of technology. It's the overuse of technology. And also, I have a very strong feeling about people becoming so addicted to their technology that they've lost a sense of the natural world.
I totally agree with you there, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And there's so few people get to experience it. We have this 22-acre. It's bordered on two sides by wildlands, and it's a wildlife sanctuary. And we also have a guest place, a casita that we rent out. And so we get people from all over the world, and they come out here. But most of them are cities. And they come out here and they're just struck dumb by the quiet and the serenity and the wildlife that's right in front of them that, even if it's just a jackrabbit or a roadrunner, or it could be a coyote or a wolf, not a wolf, but a fox. And it takes them a while to, you know, kind of get it, but then they do, and it's like their eyes are blown open. And but I think of how few people really get to experience this kind of thing, and I just feel like more people need that. More people need to get back to, I know it kind of sounds weird, but get back to the earth. But we're raping this planet in so many ways, and it's because people don't love the planet anymore.
But no, I totally agree, and I think the earth is a really beautiful place. It's one of my favorite planets for sure.
Yeah.
And but it's interesting in your work, are there different emotions possible for different alien civilizations like the Anunnaki? Do you think, I mean, it's all hypothesized, but could they do feel differently than humans, right? They have the different...
Minorly. I think that even, at least I can only speak for my Anunnaki, characters from the world, Terry's, this planet in our solar system. But even they, in their past history, they're humans. They're nothing but human beings who ended up, you know, on a different planet in our solar system. And so they have literally bred certain emotions out of them because they have learned that emotions will destroy things and they wreck the greatest cultures. And so that was their solution, to use, you know, genetic manipulation on themselves. So they're very peaceful people, but they don't have much passion.
Well, and some people say that happened to the grays, the gray ETs.
Oh, that's a whole other guy. And, you know, I'm really not much of a expert on them. They do show up in my story later in book two. Oh. I believe they've been here. They're just too much evidence that they've been here. In my estimation, or I shouldn't say estimation, but the way I've chosen to define them in my books, and this may be true, may not be true, I say they're from a different dimension. I say that the Anunnaki, the human aliens, just from a different planet in our solar system, they're like you and me. But the grays, they're, they're a whole different can of worms.
But aren't we evolving? I mean, hopefully in our emotions. I mean, there's been some great compassionate beings that showed us what's possible, you know, Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Have we learned so much? I don't know. Maybe this is where we find out if you're an optimist and I'm a pessimist.
Well, I think the potential, I think we're here. I mean, I believe in reincarnation. I think in each lifetime we are, evolving, getting more compassionate, more aware, more loving, if you want to put it that way. I mean, I think that's part.
Do you feel that way, really? Yeah.
I feel that's. You don't feel that. What do you feel?
I think it's getting worse. I think there's less compassion. I mean, look, there are always people who do wonderful things, but you know, maybe it's the leaders. I don't know. People are having a really hard time. There's so much ignorance, and hatred, and violence against each other. I just have a hard time with that, and I have a hard time thinking that some of us are definitely evolving better, but a lot of us are definitely evolving into a worse, darker place.
You mean like Donald Trump, right?
Well, yeah, and the supporters, you know, the people who support that kind of hatred. I don't get it. And when I think to myself just about our country, that even if it's only 23%, let's say 23% of the population supports Donald Trump, that's a lot of millions of people.
That is.
I just don't get how they can. That's a lot of people.
Politicians always represent the lowest form.
Common denominator, yeah.
And the lowest form of human life, I think, because all they.
That's true. Yeah.
After his power. And, you know, I think the ETs are, at least I think the good ones, let's say, are helping to lift us up to a greater awareness.
Well, how do you think that they're presenting themselves in the world today, the good ETs?
The good ones are helping us stretch into a unity of consciousness. I mean, we're definitely a more globally connected planet. There are wars, but I think there are less wars. I think more people have more. Yes, there's still a lot of people starving, still a lot of people in poverty, but does seem to be more of an affluence than there ever has been. I mean, I am an optimist. So you don't see that? You don't see the world as a better place than it was 100 years ago?
No. I don't know. I'm reserving my judgment about what better or worse than 100 years ago. Look, I wouldn't have wanted to be a woman any time, but when came into the world.
Well, there you go. But that's an example of an evolution.
That's true. But that's only in this country. I mean, there are still.
And Western Europe. I would say Europe, too.
And Europe, yeah. But there are hundreds, listen to this, hundreds of millions of girls every year who endure genital mutilation. And you know, that kind of thing.
You're saying hundreds of millions of girls? Hundreds?
Yes.
Wow.
I just had that fact recently. And how do you say, well, that world is better or more evolved when that's still happening?
I'm not saying that's better. There's still a lot of very low level consciousness, but it's like it happened in phases, and hopefully the people that are more evolved will stop or change or shift those awful things from happening, you know?
I would hope so. I think that's
why we're coming together as a global civilization, is to evolve in a unison of decency. I mean, that's my hope, is that the evolution will be one that will uplift all of us. And there's no reason that it shouldn't. I mean, I think religion, and that's why genital mutilation probably exists, because of traditional religious ideas. They don't really serve anybody anymore.
I'm with you on that.
Do you know that if you're born in Indonesia, someone just told me that, it's a law that you have to be a Muslim?
Indonesia. No, I just, what?
Yes,
really?
Indonesia and... was that other Malaysia? Mm-hmm. If you're not of Chinese descent, where you have a choice of being a Buddhist, if you're born as a Malaysian, I think it's Malaysia. You are this Chinese woman who immigrated from Malaysia, told me that you have to be a Muslim. You
know? Wow.
There's no choice. Huh? No choice.
Well, that's probably true in countries like, well, even Saudi Arabia. I mean,
oh, I'm sure it's true. Not only that, you know, I mean, the oppression of women.
Don't get me started on that. Oh man.
But you know, I think with the exposure to women in the West, and the freedom that, and the intelligence that, of course, another whole half the population can contribute. That's the great thing Jean Houston said. She said, with the equality of women, we double our rate of genius here.
Yeah, exactly. So no, women they're having a better run in some places. That's for sure. And I just feel so unbelievably fortunate to be born when I was, you know, what color I was, what, you know, because everybody else has had such a rough time.
But do you see your novels helping to shift the consciousness that way?
Yeah, I do. I hope
How?
They will.
How do you see that?
Well, because I think, well, like I said, it's a cautionary tale. I think that, especially in book two, I mean, book one is almost a cakewalk compared to book two, because it's a love story. It's the rise of a civilization. And it, you know, there's some definitely dramatic and bad things happen, but it's still on the upswing. Book two, where you're going to start seeing the beginning of money and greed and possessiveness and violence and slavery and, you know, all the things that we hate happening to our world today. Those we're going to see how they all started, kind of the origins of money, the origins of slavery, the origins of this and that, and then we're going to see how those negative forces, you know, destroyed the world, destroyed the civil. This
well, how
civil
how do you think it was? I mean, it's the flood, but do you think those negative forces sort of brought on, attracted it through a kind of karmic?
In my book, yeah, no. Well, in my
yes
book, and you're not going to like this, but in
oh, it's okay.
In my, I'm saying that the misuse of technology.
I agree.
Used against the planet. Used it physically.
Well,
against
nuclear
the
weapons is a great example of that. Exactly. Of that possibility.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but also there's all kinds of drilling, and you know we have drilling that goes down a few miles, but you know with this advanced technology, it can go a hell of a lot deeper in my book, and it can throw things off, and you know they just start screwing with Mother Nature, and as that commercial used, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature, and
right.
She, you know I think she's poised to give us a kick in the butt come soon.
So,
I think
it wasn't in your book. You say it wasn't a meteor or comet that caused the flooding of Atlantis. It was the misuse of their technology. Do you,
in the 11,600?
Yes.
Date, you know, the first one, I actually refer to the earlier thing, the 12,800, but that's before they come this time. I mean, this is a race who's been coming and messing with the, you know, the great apes for many, many, many thousands of years. Right. But, you know, this time they're, anyway, I just lost my train of thought.
No,
but,
no, no, I was saying that the fall of Atlantis wasn't
yeah, it's the misuse
flood.
Of it.
Yeah,
yeah. It was there was a flood, but it was caused by us.
Oh, I see. So you don't go along with the Graham Hancock theory of the flooding
of the second
flood. Yeah,
you know, it's not that I don't go along with him. It's that for the purpose of this book, and it's fiction, you know, it's historical. I call it prehistorical fiction. I've come up with a new
I like
title,
that. That's
new
funny.
Genre. I guess Jean All, you know, the Clan of the Cave
yes,
Bear
that was
book would have been prehistorical fiction. Mm-hmm. But I just, as a storyteller, I had to have a cohesive, you know, story and one that
people say. Other people have said it was the Atlantean technology that caused the flood and the quaking and the breaking up of the continent.
Was that something that like Edgar Casey said? I'm trying to remember.
I think it was Edgar Casey that called it the Dark Crystal. I think there was a movie called
the crystal. That's
yes.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
The crystal capstone and all that. Yeah. And so it's not that I go along with this one or don't go along with that one, but it worked well for my story to have it. It was realistic. Everything I do, I want to be believable. Mm-hmm. And, And it not only was believable, it was dramatic. It gave me a really great climax. I mean, you know, we're talking about 1,000 pages a book, because my first book was 529 pages, and this one's going to be long. And so I need a real dramatic and literary and character-based thrust to the story that, you know, otherwise it's just a pile of rubbish, you know.
Right.
If so you're really writing good fiction.
It has to be full of your passion and emotion.
Beliefs, you know, and even if it's not my, I'm not 100% sure that it was that, but it works for my story and it's believable. It's possible that it happened that way. That's how I decide.
And you put your, I mean, it's like, it's a way of almost you helping to express your own emotion, putting it into the character.
Yeah. You bet. As a novelist, you have to be a student of human nature, and I've been doing this for a long time. And so, and every relationship in this book has a problem, and they're all problems that I have faced or my friends have faced, and that, you know, greed, jealousy, lust, love, passion.
Don't we ever get over those things?
No, are you kidding? And they've been with us forever as a species. There's one, and I don't even know who was this scientist, or maybe it was the woman who wrote The Chalice and the Blade, but she said that when we were living in tribes, that was a peaceful world. That was kind of paradisical. It might not have been a lot of fun, but as you know, we were, it was a sharing society, and nobody had more than somebody else. Everybody worked together. The women had roles. The men had roles. It was, you know, it was pretty damn good.
Well, that's how the Aborigines live. You should look at the Aborigine culture. Yes.
That's true. Okay. Then, when agriculture came into the picture,
that's what the Aborigines never had agriculture, so they never had a hierarchy.
Right, exactly. Because when you have an excess of grain, let's say, because that's what people mostly grew in the beginning, as they grew grain, that was what agriculture was all about. You grow so much, you need to store it. And when you start to store excess of anything, that's the beginning of greed. That's, you know, you make storehouses and you put all the grain in the granary and then you protect it so nobody comes in and steals it. But people will always try to steal something, and so they get in trouble. So now you have punishment for people. And then if you start living in cities, you want to protect your homes. Before, you're just hunter-gatherers. You don't have a city or a town. And you start putting up walls. And instead of a society where kind of everybody screws everybody else, which in tribal times, I think that was what was happening, instead you have men deciding that women are their property. And so all of a sudden you can see all kinds of human problems.
Do you know what's really interesting in the Bible, in the structural analysis of the myth there? It's Cain, who's a farmer, that kills Abel, the hunter and gatherer.
Right.
And then it's a metaphor for the way agricultural societies overran the hunter and gatherer societies.
So it's really it's a fascinating thing. I'm reading a book now called Sapiens, and it's about how, you know, our species evolved. I haven't gotten that far into it, but I've always been fascinated with, and what you said about the show in general. Your show is about the evolution of human consciousness, and that's always been my favorite subject.
Right. And, you know, when I visited the Aborigines in Australia, they, I mean, they were no longer the full bloods living out in the outback, but they had, they do have the oldest continuous culture, and they're very, very spiritual, very, very conscious. If you want to read a great book about them, read Voices of the First Day by Robert Lawler.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Voices of the First Day. It will, okay. That might actually really influence your writing in some way.
Thank you.
Robert Lawler, Lawlor. He's actually a pretty amazing guy, Robert Lawler. He also wrote a book on sacred geometry. Wrote a book about.
He actually wrote
the first book, so he says, on sacred geometry for Thames on the Hudson. Mm-hmm. And he's written. His last book was called the Geometry of the End of Time, how we're coming to the end of the Kali Yuga cycle. I want to just ask you about as your story as Atlantis declines in your stories. Does the civilization then get brought to Egypt, as some people say?
Well, yeah. Uh huh. Well, that will be book three. Book three will be about the survivors of Atlantis and where they kind of went off to Egypt. They went off to South America. They went all the cultures who, the Sumerians, for example. I don't know. Did we talk about the Epic of Gilgamesh?
No. I think, what do you make of the Epic of Gilgamesh?
Well, I just read it. I've been referring to it for years because I read about it in Zechariah Sitchin's books.
Yeah.
And, but I didn't actually listen to it until recently. And I listened to a lot of books on tape. So I listened to that one and it was fascinating. And I learned a whole lot of things. It was the first bromance. It was a homosexual love story.
They don't come right out and say that, but I guess it was
close to it. Yeah. But the thing that was that was one of those great facts or whatever you want to call it that I get to use, not in this book but in my next book, is that one of the things that Gilgamesh and Enkidu, his boyfriend and kind of protector, they go off on a great adventure together and they go to slay a beast in the forest. But guess who they meet? They meet Noah. I mean, he's got a different name. He's got a different. Are you there?
Yeah. Oh, we do have to wrap up soon, but yes.
Yeah, but he's got a different name, but he is the guy from the older civilization who brings with him the, you know, all the animals, all the species. So it's no, I didn't know that there was a Noah in the Epic of Gilgamesh, but he will end up being one of the sons of Poseidon, one of the children of Ra.
Well, that's so a really interesting mixture of the Greco-Roman with the Judeo-Christian, you know.
Mm-hmm,
We do have to wrap up here, but I just want to tell everyone that I've been talking to Robin Maxwell. She will be one of the featured speakers at Contact in the Desert. That's June 3rd to the 6th in Joshua Tree, California. Go to contactinthedesert.com. Her last book is called Atlantos. And what's your website, Robin?
It's www.robin with an I, robinmaxwell.com.
Well, it's been very, very interesting.
You can see all my books on there. Yeah. Oh, it's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you, Ellen.
Yeah. Maybe Graham Hancock could be in discussion with you. I know we said I was going to interview, but it might be even more interesting if you and Graham had an interesting discussion.
Well, I think he's got a pretty busy schedule. He's doing a talk, a workshop, and an intensive. But, you know, we'll talk about it.
I just want to say, you've been listening to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. Go to youtube.com/newrealities. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.